From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 8 in 10 Americans will never see the Milky Way from near their home. Man-made light is taking over the night, banishing true darkness. My guest, Paul Bogard, says there's a cost to what we are ignoring here. When it comes to light and darkness, this hour On Point, our vanishing darkness. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. What do you see when you look to the sky? The Big Dipper, the Milky Way, the reflected light from your city, your town. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from St. Paul, Minnesota is Paul Bogard, author of the new book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Paul Bogard, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be here, Tom. Thanks.
I think you're up north on vacation. I think you're not staying in St. Paul, but up near the Canadian border. What do you see from your little place in the woods on these summer nights, Paul?
Well, I'll tell you, just a few nights ago, I went out. We had a perfect night to see the Perseid meteor shower. So I took the canoe out in the middle of the lake and just flat glass water with reflected stars and the Milky Way arcing from one horizon to the other, and just watched the show and listened to the quiet of the beautiful Northwoods night.
Okay, we're suitably jealous now, and you point out in your book that we do not all have that experience
right,
these days.
Right.
That's a Northwoods night. Here's a little southern summer night to get us in the mood for night and darkness. All right, there's the sound of night. What's happening to light and dark at night, Paul?
Well, we're disrupting the natural patterns of light and dark in ways that are getting in the way of our health, our physical health, I think our spiritual, our mental health, and also the health of the ecosystems that we rely on. And we're getting in the way of what was for so long one of the most common human experiences of walking out and coming face to face with the universe. That's now become one of the most rare human experiences.
Give us some of the numbers here on night and darkness and what has changed. I mean, of course, before gaslight, I guess, and certainly before Thomas Edison and electric light, everybody lived in near darkness at night. Where does that stand today in the developed world, Paul?
Well, in the developed world, almost all of us now live in the light, I guess I would say. It's interesting that, you know, if you ask folks, does it get dark where you live at night, I think most people would probably say, yeah, more or less. But the truth of the matter is that it really doesn't get dark as it did, even in the rural areas, even in the wild areas. And I'll give you an example of that, which is about 10 or 12 years ago, a couple Italian astronomers put together what they called the World Atlas of the Artificial Night Sky Brightness, which is a computer-generated color map that really shows the true extent of light pollution. Because it's tempting to think that, oh, if you get away from the cities, it's still dark. But they showed that, in fact, you know, east of the Mississippi, for example, there's almost no place you can go that where the sky isn't at least somewhat impeded by the light.
Now, I grew up in quite rural Illinois at a time when the Milky Way was a very regular presence. You could look up, and if I wasn't mistaken, not only could you see it, but I had the feeling that on some nights, the Milky Way itself, not the moon, but even on a moonless Milky Way night, it was even illuminating the ground beneath our feet. You know, since then, I lived in Hong Kong and Tokyo and a lot of very bright cities where you might look up and see one star or planet or none.
Right, right. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. If you get into a dark enough place, the sky actually begins to lighten the earth. I had an amazing experience back when I was 18 and backpacking through Europe, where I was down in southern Morocco at the edge of the Sahara Desert, woke one night and walked out in the middle of the night. And as a good Minnesota boy, my first thought was, it's snowing. And of course, it wasn't snowing. It was just that there were so many stars from all around me on the edges of the horizon, all over me. And it was so bright. There were so many stars that it was bright enough to see the ground around me and no artificial lights in any direction. So.
How much of the United States would that be the case today?
Well, you know, there's an interesting scale that I use in the book called the Bortle scale that is a 9-point scale that basically ranks darkness, starting with 9 being the brightest places down to 1 being our darkest places, and kind of that primitive darkness that I was just talking about. And in the U.S. now, it's estimated, a lot of folks I talked to said that there probably aren't any 1 spots left in the lower 48. Maybe on some nights you might get lucky and find yourself there, but for the most part, there's almost no place you can go down here that you can get back to that truly primitive darkness where there's just no evidence of artificial light.
What are the brightest places in the United States? Maybe it's obvious, maybe it's not.
Well, it's actually a really good question. I mean, I think I started in Las Vegas, which is kind of the obvious maybe answer. And in fact, the folks I talked to said on their photographs of the Earth at night, Las Vegas, and especially the Luxor beam of the Luxor Casino, is the brightest pixel on their photographs of any place in the world. I also went to Times Square, which was an amazing, bright experience too. But, you know, the thing I think people don't realize, of course, those places would be 9s on this scale I was just talking about, but really any major American city is going to be that bright as well, just because of the sheer numbers of lights.
So what does it matter? We know it in terms of poetry and in terms of awe. I really miss that sky full of stars. I really miss it. And sometimes I go out at night now and I really resent looking up and seeing, you know, a lot of nights, just 3, 4, 5, 6 points of light in the sky. But then, you know, I go back inside and turn in and that's that. What's the cost?
Well, you're touching on a number of really interesting things, important things. One is that I think, you know, you and I and some of us lucky folks know what we're missing, but for so many Americans, they have no idea what they're missing. And we can come back to that maybe. But in terms of, you know, this goes way beyond just an aesthetic issue. As important as that is, as important as that firsthand experience of seeing a true night sky is, we're also talking about human health issues. We're talking about ecological issues. We're talking about a huge waste of money. And really, actually, we're talking about making ourselves, it's kind of counterintuitively, but actually less safe and secure at night with all this light than we think we're making ourselves.
Less safe and secure? I mean, you quote people from back in the age of dark cities, and they were really dark, and they could be quite dangerous. And, you know, we talk about poetry now, but go back a few centuries, people cursed the darkness very often.
Absolutely. And I think the important point that I would make is just that we're not talking about not having lights. You know, the folks that I talked to who are deeply engaged in this issue made the point again and again that we're not saying let's not have lights. What we're saying is let's use light more intelligently, more thoughtfully, more efficiently than we are. I'll give you a good example of this where, and there's for folks who have seen the book or have the book, I have these pictures in the book. There's a wonderful example of what we call glare coming from a security light that is actually blinding your vision of anything beyond that light. But the minute you hold your hand up to block that glare, you can then see beyond it. And all we're doing that, we're not turning the light off. All we're doing there is just shielding that light. So the light is actually just not blazing into your eyes and blinding you. And the point being there that the first picture, super bright light, actually makes you less safe and secure because you can't see anything beyond that light. But if you shield that light, which also would keep the light from going up into the sky, you then can see better, and that would improve our safety and security.
So you're saying, in part, let's redesign our lights so they don't leak so much light up into space? Is that part of what you're looking at there?
Absolutely. And I think that touches on one of the things that I really love about this issue, which is that we can so readily address it. And, you know, we can so readily change the style of our light. And in fact, we're seeing that in a number of cities. We're even seeing that, for example, with the home improvement chain Lowe's now has a new line of lights that you can buy for your house. They're called Good Neighbor Lighting. And that speaks to another thing, a term we use, which is called light trespass. And I think a lot of your listeners probably have this experience where their neighbor's bright security light is blasting into their bedroom next door or down the street. And that's not really being a good neighbor. So these lights do the same thing I was just talking about, where they just shield the light. They can light your doorway. They can light your yard if you like, but they don't you know, illuminate your neighbor's bedroom.
That sounds awesome. I mean, I'd like my neighbors to have those. I should have them too.
Exactly.
We should all have them. Sounds like a great idea.
Yeah. Absolutely.
What's your favorite little piece of poetry out of your pursuit of light and dark?
You know, I love the poem at the beginning of the book from Wendell Berry, To Know the Dark. And that's why I chose it as my epigraph. I think when he says, to know the dark, go dark, you know, so often, even if we do get out into the woods, if we go camping or we're up north, wherever north is, we take our flashlight with us and it just cuts away the dark and it just gives us the light.
To know the dark, go dark, go without sight and find that the dark too blooms and sings and is traveled by dark feet and dark wings. Poem from Wendell Berry there. Nick Drake behind us with Pink Moon. Paul, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Zoe written and a Zoe say, Pink Moon is on its way. None of you stand so tall. Pink Moon gonna get you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about all the light at night, what's happened to darkness, and why it may matter. Paul Bogard is my guest. He's author of the new book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. For an excerpt, you can go to our website, onpointradio.org. Paul has gone all over the world looking for light and dark, especially dark. He joins us today from St. Paul, Minnesota. He's up north, back home. Home turf, it sounds like, for a little bit of the summer here. Here's a little bit from the 2012 documentary, The City Dark, examining what's lost in the glare of city lights. In an interview for the film, this is Professor Irving Robbins talking about light pollution erasing a work of art, the stars, from the sky.
When you look at the sky, the light in the sky really is a sum total of everything around you. It's like I have a beautiful painting, right? Very nice, but now I come along and erase it, and I erase all of it and just leave a few spots. That's what light pollution does.
That's what it does, and we know what it gets rid of. Paul Bogard, you remind us or tell us that, you know, we may have young people now who, depending where they've grown up, may never have seen that night sky full of stars.
Yeah, I think that's one of the real costs here is that our children are not experiencing the wonder of the night sky. They're not having that what has forever been the most common human experience of gazing up into the sky face to face with those billions of stars and just wondering who you are, what is life, where am I going, all that kind of thing. Instead, like when I was in Times Square, for example, and I looked up and there was nothing above me. It was like as though I was in a domed stadium. Mm-hmm. Everything was just washed out.
You've got so many people responding to this online. George writes to us, says, do I miss a starry night sky? Yes. He writes, in the early 1960s, I settled on a small Greek island, lucky already, that had generator electricity only until 10 each evening. Needless to say, no television. Tavernas that stayed open after the power cut used candles and paraffin lanterns. On a summery evening, we would lie on our backs on his Greek isle and stare in wonderment at the Milky Way, so much more grand and bewildering than we had ever considered. And our concentrations, which often lasted for ecstatic hours, were only interrupted by the frequent cascade of brilliant shooting stars. Mm. To live in such close proximity and intimacy with the heavens was truly blissful and sorely missed now. Well, I'm full of jealousy, but also that sounds like it should be a human birthright.
I think so. And in fact, I talked with somebody in Spain who has actually worked on making it a right of all human beings to have a starry night. And he's actually gotten UN approval for this. And the only problem is, of course, enforcing that right.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Exactly.
Let's go to Joel in Cary, North Carolina. Joel, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Well, what do you know?
I just want to make a comment that I was a Peace Corps volunteer in East Africa back in the mid-80s. The night sky really was one of the things that really just really impressed me. It left an impression on me that lasts till today. it was something that allowed me to gauge the passage of time, not only by watching the rotation of the Dipper or the Southern Cross in the course of a night, but just to be able to see where the constellations were seasonally. And I really regret that coming home that I've had children, they're full grown, and they don't understand lunar cycles or just the basic constellations and how the stars actually track in the sky.
Yeah, there's magic up there, but there's also actual information that can be quite helpful if you understand something about it. They're in East Africa and elsewhere. Joel, thanks for that. One more right here. Ellen in Braintree, Massachusetts. Ellen, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Paul.
Hi.
Thank you for this topic. I had the opportunity to recently, I don't know if you're familiar with this, it was on the POV series out on PBS, and it was The City Dark by Ian Cheney, I believe.
Yeah.
A lovely documentary. And I agree with you, Tom, when you said you resented not seeing the night sky. I remember several years ago I had an opportunity to go upstate New York, and I saw the Milky Way. I think it was, anyway. It was some evening constellation I'd never seen. In the documentary, however, and I have to read this book because it sounds lovely, it talked about the impact of not having a night sky on birds and nature. And I kept thinking, how is it affecting us as humans? So I really think there's a spiritual disconnect. And I just wanted to share that, and thank you for having the show.
You are so welcome, Ellen. I appreciate your call. A spiritual part, we'll look more at that. Also, you say physical impacts for not only humans, as Ellen points out. Like what, Paul?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what a wonderful call, and I think she touches on what is maybe the most motivating issue for me, which is ecological health, the fact that all life on Earth has evolved with bright days and dark nights. And that's the natural rhythm that we all need, humans included, for optimal health. And so in terms of ecological health, for example, we have now about 60% of all invertebrates and 30% of vertebrates species who are truly nocturnal, active at night. And then we have so many other species that are crepuscular. They're active most at dawn and dusk. And for these species that have evolved over billions of years to depend on darkness, they do all their maiden living in the dark. For us to just be careless about our use of light and blast into their habitat, I equate it to being as destructive as a bulldozer during the daytime. It's just wiping out, destroying their habitat for all these creatures.
Their light or darkness habitat. Is there evidence of damage from the light?
With the creatures, the interesting thing, and it makes a lot of sense, we're just beginning to gather this kind of evidence over the last couple decades. We're just because of the explosion and the recent explosion of our use of light. But we're beginning to see things like studies that show us what's happening with migration patterns in salmon, for example, or lots of people have probably heard about the effects of light on turtles, or as your caller suggested, the impact on migratory birds. There are more than 400 species of birds that migrate in North America, and they're often drawn off course by our bright lights. And we lose, the figure that I use in the book is between 100 million and a billion birds every year to collisions with human-made structures. And it's a wide range, but the point is that we don't really know. There's so many of them that are meeting their end this way, and we just don't even know how many.
Barbara in Mount Juliet, Tennessee. Barbara, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to say we moved up here in 75. I'm right out of Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
And where we're living at now is close to Old Hickory Lake. And we moved over here in 85. And when we first moved over here, I could look up and see stars in the sky. And we've just grown so much up here with malls and everything. It's just a reflection of the light, into the sky now where I can't see anything like I used to.
And is it city light, Barbara, or is it your neighbor's, security light out back? Or?
A little bit of everything. We've got new malls around and a lot more growth. And some people put up those pole lights,
sure. Mm-hmm. Of course.
because it was quite dark back here when we first moved up here, and I guess some of them had the electric company put them up for security reasons.
And that's well within your lifetime, just since the 70s. Barbara, I appreciate your call. Paul Bogard, we've got Deborah also writing in. She says, we don't have streetlights in our subdivision, and our houses lie on the edge of several Kentucky bluegrass horse farms. It should be ideal for star watching, Deborah writes. But our neighbors are so afraid that they have all kinds of lights shining on their houses at night, including some of those awful bright yellow ones. For some, the lights on the houses are a style issue. When we suggest an occasional blackout so we can see a meteor shower, many say that having the lights on is a safety issue, Deborah writes. You know, even not near a city, but it's her neighbors lighting their houses for all kinds of reasons. Put up that umbrella of light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I hear the story all the time, and I just wonder what we're afraid of. It's as though we think that if we turn off the lights to watch the stars for an hour or two, that suddenly our subdivision out in the country is going to be overrun by criminals or something. And I think with this issue, one of the reasons I'm optimistic about it is that when we really start to think about it, when we really consider our use of light and how important darkness is, I think most people will realize that we're using light irresponsibly. We're using way more light than we really need for safety and security, and that we can do things in a more thoughtful way.
I wonder, though, well, maybe some places here. Erica writes to us. She says, coastal towns here in Oregon recently passed some ordinances regarding this very issue. They seem practical and a good start. Whether in the U.S. or abroad, do you see governments, national, local, moving in to try and rein things in?
Absolutely. I think we're seeing it in this country on the local level. Places Long Island, Pennsylvania, Arizona, all over the country. One of the most exciting things that's just happened is the country of France has just instituted last month new lighting laws countrywide. And this includes the famous City of Light, Paris. And these, again, seem very practical, very reasonable rules, including things like storefronts need to turn off their lights after 1 o'clock in the morning. Public buildings' interior lights need to be turned off an hour after the last person leaves instead of being left on all night, that kind of thing. And I just think there are real reasonable, practical moves we can make that would make a significant, helpful change.
What are the major sources of light pollution, if you want to call it that? Is it private homes? Is it street lighting? What are they?
Well, overall, the main sources are streetlights, for sure. Also gas stations, parking lots, that kind of thing. I think in individual cases, like your recent caller, the main source of light there is her neighbors just being unthinking and maybe a little uncaring there. But overall, it's just this obsession with everything should be lit up. And we think that because some light helps us become more safe and more secure, that more light and ever more light will help us become ever more secure. And so we try to fill up the space with light, and it really doesn't work well.
Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Back in the late 60s, when I was 10, 11 years old, we used to go up to the farm of a family friend's farm in western Maine.
Yeah.
It wasn't really that far north. It was around Sebago Lake. And we would go out at night, and like your caller from earlier said, we would lie on our backs, grown men, little kids, and we would just stare at the sky. Sometimes there would be no word spoken for 10 minutes straight as we just looked at this spectacular thing. It had a 10-year-old, all the little things that a kid can get excited about on a farm.
Yeah.
The thing that I cared about most was looking at that sky at night, and I haven't seen it since. I'm 56 years old now, and I haven't seen that view since sometime around 1969, and it was the most spectacular thing. I think views on Earth, I think that the Grand Canyon pales by comparison to what you can see if you could look at the sky like that. That thick band of the Milky Way running through the middle of the sky, and I miss it. And
yeah, I know exactly what you mean, Kevin. I mean, it's an ache for that. It is so spectacular. It's almost unimaginable. I mean, it's way beyond a constellation. It really does look like a vast river up there when you can see it. Just wonderful. One more here. Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. There were two things that occurred to me. I walk very early in the morning from around 4 to 8, total idiot, but this gives you something of the sky and color. Mm-hmm. But the big thing for me is I spend a lot of time in Canada north. And, of course, once you're away from cities, you know, like Quebec and Ottawa and so on, it is, as you point out, stunning. The Milky Way is just this absolute river of light. And there, because there's the atmosphere, at times there's this almost azure glow that is just simply extraordinary. It almost seems to shift as you watch it. I don't know whether that really happens or not. And then the other thing that was the reverse of it, thinking back to prehistoric men, you know, back to our prehistoric ancestors and the terrible fear that they had of the night, you know, of saber-toothed tigers and dire wolves snooping around. Mm-hmm. And that incredible contrast between that point and then to where we are now. And then also to your commentator's point that people are really missing out all over by sort of staring into the gadgets in their hands, I don't know, looking for the Holy Grail, the latest app. Mm-hmm. And they don't see the wonder that's above them in cirrus clouds and swirls of color, night, moonlight, the whole works.
The whole works. You can be left agog so easily, Peter. I love the way you bring it home to us. But it is out of reach for so many. And I just wonder, if you say you're optimistic that it will change, Paul, but if you get generations now who have not really seen it, who haven't felt that the breath taken away by it, what's going to make them change to revive it?
No, exactly. I mean, that's an enormous problem. I think, though, the word change is something we can dwell on for a second, because our nights are going to change in the coming decades, for sure. And it's up to us how they will change. And I can point directly to the changing technology. You know, we've gone from oil lamps to gas lamps to electric lamps, and now we're moving to electronic lighting, the LEDs you see all over the place.
Is that better?
Well, it holds both promise and peril. And the promise is that LEDs can be they're programmable. You can program, you know, with your computer. A community could program their streetlights to become a little dimmer at 1 o'clock in the morning, and maybe, you know, go off at 3 o'clock in the morning, that kind of thing. But the peril is that it will just mean more light everywhere, because these lights tend to be more intense, and we tend to use them at the same levels that we're using the electric lights. So that's the peril, promise and peril. And it's really up. We're resting right on the edge. Which direction do we go with our nights?
Here's Yola Tengo with Night Falls on Hoboken. We're loving the dark this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about all the light at night and what's happened to darkness and why it may matter with Paul Bogard, author of the new book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Paul joins us from St. Paul, Minnesota. He's up in northern Minnesota on vacation, north of St. Paul, up near the Canadian border. Lucky him with dark skies there. Here's Bill Nye, science guy, in a public service announcement by the Dark Sky Association.
Think about it. Think of all the energy we waste by blasting all this light into space every night. But perhaps more importantly, we can't see the stars. When we don't see the stars, we're not aware of our place in the cosmos. We lose our sense of our place in space. So let's work together and direct the light down instead of up. We can change the world and see the stars again.
Bill Nye and Paul Bogard say it doesn't have to be this way. We don't have to beam all this light around so carelessly, so casually. We can live with a little less, a little more focused, and get back to the splendor of real night. Let's go to Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
When we lose the night, we lose it all around. We lose it on the ground. We lose it up in the atmosphere. We lose it in the universe. I mean, We are so totally out of touch with our surroundings, I can't even begin to cover it. The other night, about three or four nights back, I should describe where I live. I live in Northborough, but I live totally devoid without an outside light.
Okay.
I'm surrounded by woods. I have no lawn. I'm surrounded by trees, natural ground growth. I parked my car in my driveway, was going down the driveway. I've got logs along the side, stumps, all this other sort of thing.
Yeah.
Any event, I was going down the driveway, walking down the driveway, and in total darkness, my eye caught something on the side, and it looked like something was glowing. And I kept staring at it, and it was glowing and glowing. And then I found myself going down on my knees.
Yeah.
I'm looking at this thing. I'm getting closer and closer.
Yeah.
And this fungus on the log was fluorescent.
Wow.
And I had never seen this before.
And you wouldn't if there was ambient light.
Exactly. And I'm staring at this, and I'm saying, no, this can't be. And then I went to the house, and then I went back. I got my flashlight, and then I went back there. I turned off the flashlight, and son of a gun, this stuff was glowing.
Yeah.
I went back the following night, and it was glowing again. Now, I mean, I've seen bats at night. I've seen all sorts of things
sure.
at night. I mean, I've gone out and filled up my bird feeders and discovered that another bird feeder right next to me, there's a skunk feeding on the seeds on the ground. It's
yeah.
not bothering me, and I
yeah.
you know, discovered it to my surprise. I mean, people are so out of touch with their surroundings, day or night.
Yeah, well, I mean, that you've got a big point there and a true one. What, there's an app now on smartphones that while you're walking and looking down at your smartphone, it actually will show the sidewalk ahead of you. So you don't even have to look up and pull your nose out of it ever. But that fluorescent fungus down your drive, Bill, that's just a tremendous image and just another reminder of all the nuance of what's out there in the dark, if we only have the dark. I appreciate your call, Bill. Paul, what did humans think when large-scale light began to come onto the scene? Did they welcome it? Did they fear the kind of, you know, overwhelming of night that we have now by light, or were they just happy to have lamplight along the street and electric later?
What I've seen is that most were happy to have it, but there's kind of a funny thing that happens. I was talking about the succession of lighting technologies, and it's funny to read gas lamps first came in, people were so excited about the gas lamps, and the minute they saw electricity, they thought the gas lamps were so old school. It was, electricity was so much better, that kind of thing. But maybe we just don't hear the voices, though, that saw that maybe this wasn't so good. There's a poem by Robert Louis Stevenson where he talks about how much he loved the gas lamp, the gas lamp lighters in London when he was a child, and he could see that they were going to lose their jobs as electricity came, and he was mourning that and really calling our attention to, he calls the new electric light at that time was super bright, very bright and very glary, and he called it
arc
a
light
lamp.
It was, I think.
Yeah, exactly,
wow,
exactly.
Amazing.
And he calls it a lamp for a nightmare. I love that phrase.
Mm, too much brightness right there.
Mm-hmm.
Tyner in Augusta, Georgia. Tyner, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Okay.
I'm 22 years old, and I've never seen the Milky Way, like, in its full glory. I've always wanted to. I can see constellations out of my back window, Orion maybe,
yep.
but mm-hmm. never the full glory of the dust and debris and
all
the beautiful colors. I was going to ask your guest maybe if he knew of any places in the United States it's really good to go view that.
All right, Paul, help out Tyner. There he is in Augusta, Georgia. If he wants to set out to see the Milky Way, which way would you have him travel?
Boy, if you can get out west, that's the first thing I'd say. The national parks out west, well, all over the country, but especially out west, are doing a fantastic job of seeing darkness as one of the resources that they're sworn to protect. And so they're measuring the levels of darkness out there, and they're trying to change the lighting in the parks and to talk to the communities around the parks about their lighting and really preserve that experience for visitors. But even on the East Coast, there are good places to go. I'm thinking of the Outer Banks in North Carolina, if you can get up there. There's a wonderful star party down in Florida, Harmony, Florida. There are other places in the East where even if it's not 100% as it was, 100 years ago, it's still going to be beautiful and you get that effect. And I would encourage folks to visit, somebody earlier mentioned the International Dark Sky Association, but their website, darksky.org, for any of the issues we've talked about is a really wonderful resource to get started learning more about this.
Tyner, brace yourself. I remember years ago taking a flight from Tokyo, very, very bright indeed, way down to the South Pacific, little tiny islands called Vanuatu, far from anything and very little artificial light. And the combination of the southern sky, this is south of the equator, deep south of the equator, which I was not as accustomed to, and the deep dark, I mean, I almost had a panic attack looking at the scale and brightness and depth and sort of overwhelming number of stars. It was, it's pretty dazzling when you see it. My main thing, I'm a twilight guy above all. You quote Robin Wall Kimmerer here, talking about that long blue moment. But even twilight gets hit when you get light pollution coming in.
Absolutely. We lose that experience of seeing night actually rises. It doesn't fall, and you have that wonderful experience. I wanted to just quickly go back to something your caller said, which Tyner, he mentioned the being able to see some of the constellations and specifically Orion. And I remember I was living in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, a couple of years ago, and walking home from work and in the evening, or actually after dark, and I saw Orion, and I thought, hey, I can still see Orion. But then I thought, yeah, but the stars in Orion are brighter than 98 or 99% of the other stars in the sky, which means I'm not seeing 98 or 99% of the stars. I'm only seeing those brightest 1 or 2%. That's what we're missing.
Well, thank goodness for the big warrior who still comes through there, Orion. Mm-hmm. Jenny in Manchester, Vermont. Jenny, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
There is an established link between breast and prostate cancer and artificial nighttime light exposure. Not natural light like moonlight or firelight, but artificial. And this is an established link. It's not some wacky theory. And this is really a huge problem, not just because of the bombardment of light in our cities. Like where I live part-time in Brooklyn, it's horrific. They have highway lights on the streets in the neighborhoods. Highway lights that stretch up as high as the building so there's no escape.
Yeah.
And we put blackout shades so that we're not exposed to it.
Yeah.
But not everybody knows about this. I think it's very important.
Jenny, I so appreciate your call. Paul Bogard, you write about this. Now, you take some care in how you put it, but you say, as Jenny does, that there are studies showing some evidence of a link between breast and prostate cancer and artificial night light. Like what?
Well, absolutely. And I'm really grateful for the call because this issue of human health is so key. I think it's maybe too easy for our listeners to sit out there and think, well, we're hearing these stories about people from the past or people from remote areas and, seeing the Milky Way and stuff, but how does that impact my life here in the city or the suburb? And this human health link, the studies that are showing the link between artificial light at night and human health, illness, disease. I'll give you three quick examples. We are disrupting our sleep with all this light, and sleep disorders are tied to every major disease we're dealing with right now. We are confusing our circadian rhythms, those 24-hour rhythms that are keyed by the natural rhythm of light and dark and are tied to the internal biological processes in our body. And then thirdly is the one that your caller touched on, which is we're impeding the production of the hormone melatonin in our body, which is only produced at night. And the lack of melatonin in the bloodstream now is being linked to an increased risk of developing breast and prostate cancer. So, nobody was willing to say to me, light at night gives you cancer. I don't think anybody can say that directly, but it seems to be that our huge use of light at night is having very serious effects on our health. And as one guy said to me, we don't really know what's happening. It's like we're conducting an enormous ongoing experiment on ourselves.
Watch this space. Jenny, I'm so glad you raised it. Thank you for that. Roy in Phoenix City, Alabama. Roy, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I was born and raised in a small town in Central Florida. And this will tell my age, but we used to go out on the car and look up and watch Sputnik go.
Oh, Roy, I'm afraid we're losing you there, but thinking back to Sputnik going overhead back in the day, if the cloud cover or the light umbrella gets too low, you won't see that and much more. Roy, sorry we lost you, but thanks for your call. One more here. Drew in Enid, Oklahoma. Drew, you're on.
Yeah, I actually grew up in rural Kansas, and what I was just wanting to talk about really was the significance of mental health and the stars. Like, just growing up as a kid, you know, you have the whole world coming in on you, sometimes feeling of doom and you're lost and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just, whenever you were feeling down or anything, I would just go out and look at the stars and really kind of realize how insignificant in a way that my problems were.
Yeah.
That these things have been burning for billions of years, and they're going to keep burning for billions of years. So it was just a way of putting in, I guess, respect my problems to the big world and what's really going on around.
Drew, you put that beautifully there from Oklahoma. But how true, whether you're a teenager getting some perspective from the stars or really at any age, Paul, there is a mental health side to this, which is just vivid.
Oh, my gosh. What a great call. I love your callers. They're touching on such wonderful things here. And I wanted to say a couple things. I felt like the caller just before that talking about Sputnik, it really, and so many of the calls, making me think about this rich shared experience that families, parents, and children have together that we're losing this experience of life and taking away from the richness of life. And then I also wanted to just mention, too, that, you know, if we control the light in our cities, people living in the cities will benefit from some of the health issues, but the folks living out in the rural areas and even in the suburbs will really benefit in terms of having this experience of true darkness return to them, because you can have a small town, a rural area, a wild area, have no lighting or have really good lighting, but if they're close enough to a big city right now, it doesn't matter because their sky is so polluted by the city's light. So if we get our city lights under control, it will have a ripple effect out into the surrounding areas. And again, another reason to be optimistic.
I mean, Adam writes and says, I love stargazing, live in Vermont, but even way here, out here in the country, we see the effects of lighting many miles away from Boston, New York, Philly. Steve in Bolton, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hey, make us quick. I'm one of those guys who live near a city, and we do see the problems that you guys were just talking about. The issue I have is that we've been trying to get a dark sky bill passed here in Massachusetts for about 12 years. Mm-hmm. One of your local experts in astronomy who comes on and gets involved with it. But as soon as we get some momentum, the lobbyists from the electrical industry come into the committee and come into the politics and the lobbying.
Yep.
And they, you know, all of a sudden the bill's lost in committee. This has been going on for over a dozen years, and it's really tough to get anything done. And it's a real shame, because you can save half of your power with full cutoff lighting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that the laws are required to have, the proposal is required to have everybody change their lighting over. It's just that when you retrofit or add new lighting, that it would be a requirement for the towns in Massachusetts to use full cutoff lighting.
Steve, our time is short, but a dark sky bill, whether in your state or well beyond it, how great that would be. It's kind of enraging. Everybody thinking about all the beauty here, to imagine the electrical industry just coming in, or lighting industry saying no to that, and the politicians just up to saluting. Is that going on, Paul?
It is. I mean, I'm so happy to hear the effort that your caller is talking about, and that's happening all over the country. But, you know, we can so readily address this issue, but it's not to say there aren't obstacles. I think one thing he touched on that I would just reiterate for the listeners is that we are wasting a lot of light, and that is money, that is energy that we don't need to be wasting.
When you hear dark sky bill in your community, think about it, be on it, pay attention to it. It's going to take a lot of voices to win back the real night. Here's Gail. I can't get to you, but I see you here in Saranac Lake, New York, saying the stars are so bright up there. The joy is going out, seeing the stars reflecting in the lake, and not knowing where the earth ends and the sky begins. Gail, thank you for that. Paul Bogard, you remind us of a lot and help get us focused on addressing this in the century ahead. We've got too much to lose here. The new book is The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Paul, enjoy your time in northern Minnesota. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
It's Grace Potter and the Nocturnals with Stars. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Can't look at the stars.